Mr. R.M. Milner, Reel 3.
The drummers, for some unknown reason, were left behind in camp. We may have been a sort of maintenance party or something. And it was nighttime. In fact, it was midnight or something. And suddenly we were all aroused. And we had to go out and sound the general alarm. Because the camp next to us was an Indian regiment, sepoys. And they had shot up all their officers. Sort of mutiny, you know. And shot up all their officers. And not only did we have to get up and sound the general alarm, there was nobody near, just a few people in camp. And we had to go and stand guard on this camp. I don't know what we'd have done, because, I mean, there was probably several hundred of them. And so I sounded the general alarm. It was about midnight. I think the only time I ever sounded it in my life. What had happened, apparently, was that a new CO in this Indian regiment wasn't au fait with the system of religious holidays for the native soldier. And he'd stopped some holiday that went without saying, you know, like we get Christmas, they have their Ramadan or whatever it was. And he said, no, nobody will go on leave. And it upset them tremendously. And as all the officers came out of the mess that night, there was somebody went there and shot them out of them.
They were killed?
Oh, yes. I went to the mass funeral. I've got a set of pictures of it now of I don't know, 6 or 7 graves, coffins on this mass funeral. And I think they disbanded the regiment as a result of it. I think it was a lesson to newly arrived officers, in point of fact, that, you know, some things are fairly inviolate, and that if the natives are accustomed to having Ramadan off, they have it off. There's nothing you do about it. You may not like it, but then you've got to live with it. I think that those were two occasions when I could say a little bit out of the ordinary for bugling, as far as I was concerned. But bugling's a great thing. Combine a band and bugle march with the band, and you play some and they play with you, and it's great stuff, you know. You can blare it away and all sorts of things. There are some calls which everybody hates, buglers I mean, and one of them is what we used to term in India blighty male. Now that's a special call. In this country you just have the male call. It's a fairly easy call. Don't ask me to hum it now, because I forget what it is, but it's a fairly easy call, and it means come and get the lettuce, boys. In India, where you only get mail call once a week, usually on Sunday, it's an exercise, rather like post-horn gallop stuff. La la ta 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 ta. That's blighty mail. And you'd be surprised how many people get their tongue tied up with their ear on or something. Can't blow it. And I've known many a bugler come in and say, just a favour, blow bloody mail. Because they couldn't manage it. And yet, without fail, we would all practice blighty mail when we went on bugle practice. We'd all have a go at this blighty mail, trying to get better than the next. That was, it was a sort of bit of competition. I can blow blighty mail better than he can, you see. About the only call that was disliked, I think. Loved by everybody in the battalion. When they heard that, they all mail. And the old corps come and stacks of mail and chuck it out. Like you see that. And this is where the Dear John letters used to come in.
What did you call it?
Puggle Gymkhana. Puggled means crazy. It's, you see, what we do out there is we adapt ourselves to certain words in the native vocabulary that are easy to come by, and puggle is one of them. We say a bloke's puggled, which means he's nutty, he's a nutcase. And so we use this, it's easier to say a puggle Gymkhana than a nutcase Gymkhana, I suppose. You just say it's a puggle Gymkhana, and what do? People dress up as this, that and the other, and they have sideshows. It's the same sort of thing that you could see here in fairgrounds, you know, we have stalls and this sort of thing, but we dress up the part. all our uniform out there was khaki drill, shorts and longs, and what we could get besides. The other thing that we used to do, you could go to a tailor, a native tailor known as a Dersey, and say, Dersey, perhaps show him a picture, and say, I want one like that. And he would look at you and say, I just said you come tomorrow. And tomorrow there would be a replica of that that would fit you. He'd never touched, he'd never put a tape anywhere. But tomorrow there would be a replica of that and it would fit you. And you'd say, Acha, how much? And it would be something ridiculous, like 8 rupees, which is 10 bob, something like this. Because some of the people I met out there, I used to think that the tailors were out of this world. The Dersey was a very clever man. He sat on the floor with his sewing machine. So was the shoemaker. You put your foot on that and he'd draw around it and then produce you a pair of shoes that fitted you. Each separate foot, if you like.
What sort of quality of stuff did they make?
Good. Good stuff. And to save money, a khaki tunic, the old stuff, not the battle dress stuff, but with the buttons all up to the neck. When you had worn it, and you only wore this in the winter, in the summer you wore summer clothes, in the winter you put this stuff on. When you'd worn it for 2 or 3 winters, you'd get a little bit frayed and this sort of thing, you could take this tunic to the Dersey and say, change it. And he would turn the whole thing inside out and put it together again. Put it on, looked like a new tunic. But, and you couldn't say, where's the buttonholes? Oh, that's them, that's right. You know, this sort of thing. It was so well done. I used to admire the Dersey tremendously. I thought they were awfully clever. And I used to have 1 or 2 pairs of shoes made. Shoes would cost you perhaps 5 bob a pair. I don't know. It was ridiculous. And good stuff. And boots, they would make you. Army boots, they would make you. There'd be a variation between army boots and what they made you. But the only variation was that the leather would probably be a bit softer. I never had any army boots made. I was tough enough to accept the standard of army boots that were issued, which I always thought were marvellous, and I brought a pair out of the army with me. Good walking boots. One probably wouldn't wear them now after I've been out so long, but I mean, when I first came out, I think, oh, I'm glad I brought my army boots out, because they're comfortable. I've been used to it all those years, hiking up over the hills and this sort of thing. And hiking is another thing that we used to do. We used to go up to hill stations in the summer, because it was too hot on the plains. And they would encourage you to go on a fortnight's hike.
By yourself?
No, in parties, you see. We'd probably get all 8, 9, 10 of us together and say, let's go on a hike. Yeah, all right, when shall we go? And we'd decide a date, we'd go for a fortnight. And then we would decide what we were going to take in the way of food, water, this sort of thing, you know. And then we'd want bearers, and we'd by word of mouth round the charwoman or somebody would know a bearer, and we'd say, send him to us. And we'd get a bearer come and say, got a couple of donkeys? Yes, sir. And we'd say, we want to go X. That's you, sir. And he'd bring up his couple of donkeys and we'd load them up. We'd never carry anything ourselves, good heavens, no. All we used to do is boots, stockings, because of snakes. We used to wear what we called hose tops. They were stockings without any feet in. Wear ordinary socks. These were elastic around the bottoms. This wore those because of snakes, as I say. Shorts. We'd leave camp or barracks with a shirt on, but just outside, take the shirt off and walk around in singlet, until we perhaps got into the woods, when the singlet would come off as well. And if it was warm enough, the shorts would come off and we'd be in bathing trunks and boots. And a cud stick. The cuds are the hills, and we'd have a stick to take us everywhere, or to chop the head off a snake if it reared, you know, that sort of thing. And off we'd go. And we'd just send the... of stories that came back from India from people who had served their time, you know, and we dreaded this and we dreaded that. And when we got there, we found that there were just old wives' tales anyway that had been handed down and down and down. There may have been a grain of truth originally, but they'd been retold so often that, you know, it started with Mary had a little lamb, and by the time it got to me, Mary had a flock of sheep. That sort of thing, it had been embellished.
What kind of thing was it that people were dreading?
I think the heat in many respects, and there's a character called a loose swallow in it. This is a common thief who, we are told, can turn a man over in his bed and pinch his trousers from under his mattress without him knowing it and turn him back again and cover him up and creep away. This sort of thing. What used to happen if you were captured, especially on the Northwest Frontier where we were, that you were caught and handed over to the women, and I wouldn't repeat the stories that they used to tell us that used to happen. And of course, when we got there and you got mixed up, and you thought, it doesn't happen like this at all, does it? There are loose swallows, but they don't do the things that were presumably said about them. You could get captured on the Northwest Frontier, extremely unlikely though, because the frontier fighting went on in the sort of 1900 sort of period. It was all over. They were merely skirmishes that we took part in, and you could take part in a lot of them without ever firing a shot. We worked like beavers, so it wasn't Jack Jones who invented it recently. We worked like beavers out there. There were some of the things that we were told. We were told also about a bird called a kite hawk, officially, but unofficially, I leave it to your imagination, that if you put your meal on a plate and walked across the barrack square, it was gone. Because this kite hawk used to go, and they used to pick it up with their hands. Now, this literally did happen, and it caused a lot of fun. You know what we used to do? We used to tie a piece of bread on each end of a piece of string and throw the two pieces out, and two kite hawks used to come down and grab it up and fly off different ways and pull each other out of the air and things like this. We were forbidden to harm them. They're scavenger birds, kept the place clean. But that was one of the truer ones.
What did you call them?
Shite hawks. I think in many respects, affectionately, you know, although this is soldier talk, they're rude. They tend to be vulgar without really intending it. I mean, they are vulgar without intending it. I think it's a way of life. Every faction, every group of people I think that you meet have a way. I'm in the building industry at the moment. We have the floweriest language, I think, alongside the dockers and people like that in the Billingsgate fish market. Most places I've worked in the construction industry, our language is as good as theirs any day. We don't really mean anything by it. I think it's a way of life.
Well, if it's your normal vocabulary, it's no longer vulgar, because it then loses its shock value, so it's just a form of speech.
Yeah, that's with us. But at the same time, you would never hear a private soldier conversing with an officer where that language was used, not by either. Because I think discipline was far more strict in those days. I'm talking about the 1930s. Discipline was quite strict. We liked it that way. We probably resented it in many respects, but we've grown up older and wiser, and we think, my God, it did us good. Had we been as lenient as they are today with discipline, heaven knows what the army would be like. It's one period in my life I wouldn't I've missed now. But if you'd asked me before I went to India, did I want to go, I'd have said no. Having got there, I thoroughly enjoyed every minute, I think. And I think most people would tell you that. Because I look after a London association of ex-Dorsets. And we only have to have a couple of tots of whiskey, me, and a couple of pints of beer, them. And we're giggles from A to Z. Do you remember so-and-so? Do you remember all, you know, it's this all the time, and we never tire of it. And there's always somebody new popping in, and we all say, Look who's here. Haven't seen you since Dehradun in 1938, you know. And what have you been doing? And he'll say, here, guess who I saw? What did we talk about? And they talked about India. They still talk about India. And let's face it, how long have we been gone? 40 years? 30 years? Something. Wonderful life. I wouldn't miss it for anything. If I had my time over.
In addition to the rumours about what would happen to you on the northwest frontier and whatever, how much real official information did you get from the army about what to expect?
Nothing. Nothing whatsoever before leaving. Your name just appeared on a list as being due to go to India on such and such a date by such and such a troop ship, etc. And that's all. You didn't get any official information apart from the fact that they told you exactly where your regiment was stationed. And, of course, I suppose many of us used to get atlases of the world and look up these odd places that we'd never heard of and in many cases couldn't even pronounce. And it was difficult. We didn't really know where to look. Northwest Frontier is a large area, you know, and unless it's a sort of a capital place or a well-known place and the name is printed, then you suddenly find it and you say, cool, look at that. You know, you say it's somewhere near the Northwest Frontier. So you look for the Khyber Pass, knowing that much, forgetting that there are five other passes through these mountains, and you find where you're going. And you think, oh, that'll be great. But I landed, when I went to Selkot, which is in Punjab. And
what about information about climate and about health and hygiene?
Nothing whatsoever. You get your inoculations before you leave. You get nothing told you on board ship. You get on the train at, say, Karachi. And you get off the train 3 days later at Lahore or Selkot, or wherever you happen to be going. 3 days later. It's a troop train, and they disperse people all the way, sort of thing. And you find out. I mean, one goes through the Sin Desert, and one says, desert? Oh, yes, sand must be. When you get on the train, and don't forget, trains were popular in this country in those days, you find that you have a glass window, a gauze window, and a shutter. Three thicknesses of window to pull up and down, because the sand would blow in and get in your food, get in everything else. The only thing I believe we did get some information of was to be careful about drinking water. And I think most of us relied on older soldiers. Most drafts going out to India catch up with people who have been home on leave and are now going back, and you could meet one from your regiment. Are you going back? Oh, who are you? Can't remember you. Didn't? Oh, well, of course, I've been out in India for 7 years, you see, and I've been home on leave, and I'm going back. So you tend to hang around with this guy and think, I'll get to know the ropes, because everybody's a crook in India. You find this out afterwards. You don't go there with that impression. You get onto the quayside and they want to sell you everything. And of course you want to buy everything, pictures of this big... Yes, and you've changed your money. It's a fixed rate for the military, which used to be 14 rupees to the guinea, if you remember old money. And once you get these 14 rupees, like half crowns, and we used to buy this and buy that with a note and get these coins back, you see. And then we'd go on somewhere else. I always buy one of them. And you'd give two of these coins, you see, and the chap would immediately say, that's a bad one, that's a bad one. And you say, that bloke down there gave it to me, I'll have his hide. But you couldn't tell one from the other. So we're now learning about bad money. And when you go in shops, there's a little slab of marble on the counter like that. And they give you a change, you take every one and throw it on here. And if it goes clunk, you throw it back. If it goes clink, you put it in your pocket. But this is the way you find out. I think it was a rather wonderful experience. I don't know whether they could give you the right information before you left, because some of it would be so bizarre that you'd say, it can't possibly be true. But you soon pick it up out there. And that's, I think, one of the beauties of it. I loved it.
I wonder if it would have been any different for you, because you didn't go out with the whole regiment. You just...
They went with a draft.
Went out replacing a few...
Yes. I think five of us were a group. But then, don't forget, those five all knew each other because we were all musicians. I think about three drummers and two band or something like that. And I'm still in touch with some today. We went together, but there was a further draft on the boat of our soldiers, few of whom we knew. I mean, we had no reason to come across them, because the makeup of a regiment is headquarters and, you know, five companies. And a man who's in headquarters will probably know most people in headquarters, but will lack much knowledge of anybody in a company. They tend not to mix. Band and drums are a little bit select, snooty, if you like, might be the right word. But they're usually the older soldiers, because most of them started life as a band boy or a drummer boy, 15, 16, and they come up through at 18, they're men. And if you look around a band or a drums, you would see more people with three rings here than anywhere else in the regiment, because the rest of the regiment had the dirt, as we used to think, and they couldn't get out quick enough. My 7 years are up and I'm gone. Most in the band and drums signed for nine originally anyway. It was what we called a 9 and 3. That's nine from the day you're 18. But by the time you're 18, you could have 4 years service in. Well, one more year, when you're 19, you can have two up here. So it was quite quick. We had the older soldiers, I think, that was the thing, because they had a tie down for a longer period initially, and their life was that much better. We used to do parades, but you imagine all these fellas marching up and down, round and round, you know, in and out, and we're just in the band, stood still here going sink them silly so-and-so's out there. Ceremonial prayers were quite easy for us. All right, you might troop the colour and walk in front of the colour, but it's a sort of one-off. It's and this is why I think most of the band and drum types tended to remain aloof. They would know signallers, because signallers would be HQ. They would know anti-tank people. They would know transport people, because all these people come under the HQ block. And as boys, of course, they were ever boys. They were scallywags, even though I say it. And, you know, at one time or another, we would have come up against not necessarily groups, but people within HQ who were either signallers, transport, anti-tank, or something like this. And they used to say, "You bloody boys, you think..." And we should say, "Dan, hit me." You know, it's a crime, a big crime in the army in those days, for a man to hit a boy. And I've seen boys who were bigger than half the men, you know, great big fellas, and used to say, "Don't you hit me, I'll report you." And if he had one stripe up, we used to be, you know, say, "You want to lose your stripes? I'll go to Sergeant Major, lay a finger on me." And you could see these fellas gritting their teeth, saying, "You know, wait till you're 18, I'll kill you." But they never did. I think they'd all come up through that alley, you see. And if you stop and think, and I do often today, when I could swipe one of mine, I think, what did I do at that age? You see, I have one 13. The others are bigger than me. But, I mean, I think, what did I do at that age? I was rude. I was cheeky. I was a rebel. I was everything that I shouldn't have been. And yet I came through it, you know, and I enjoyed it. And I don't think, honestly, at a later stage, that people said, "Oh, that bastard, I could kill him." They said, "Oh, well, you know, he was one of the boys, wasn't he? What else did you expect," sort of thing. We were just being, I don't know, what you would call it, ebullient.
You in the drums regarded yourselves as a bit of an elite then.
Oh, yes, yes.
The soldiers. Mm. Did the ordinary soldiers regard you in that light as well?
I wouldn't have said quite so deeply as we regarded ourselves, but they probably had a sneaky sort of regard. See, we would only come in contact with them. I'm the duty bugler, and I would come in with, say, 8 men who were the duty guard, and I would have to be with them for 24 hours. Now, that's the way I would get to know somebody. And they probably would form opinions of individuals rather than the group. And they might think that, well, I like him, but I can't stand any of the others. In my case, they might say, I can't stand him, but I like all the others. But that's the sort of way I think that.